And that is not what religious freedom means. There's not a religious freedom right for the law to line up perfectly with your religious principles.
Welcome to Respecting Religion, a BJC podcast series where we talk about what's at stake for faith freedom for all in 2020. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of BJC.
And I'm BJC General Counsel Holly Holman. In this episode, we're going to talk about the Bostick versus Clayton County decision the U.S. Supreme Court released this week and the religious freedom questions that surround that decision. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Holly. Great to see you on Zoom. It was a big week at the Supreme Court. Though usually when we would have an opinion like we're going to talk about today, we'd see a huge crowd of people outside, either celebrating or lamenting the decision. And in our socially distanced time, there were no big demonstrations after this case.
Instead, we were all in our separate corners looking to connect as we have to do these days virtually and trading reactions to this big opinion, as we'll do today as we talk about this case.
Yeah, so we did address this topic and give a preview of this case back in episode 5. And we think that this decision is likely to have a big impact on the continuing conversation about religious liberty and LGBTQ rights.
That's right. For any of our listeners who may be new to this Respecting Religion podcast series, I want to remind everyone that BJC's work to protect faith freedom for all has continued through the pandemic with our work across government and particularly this busy term at the Supreme Court. We've been responding to new developments stemming from the coronavirus-related challenges. And we, as we talked about last week, we now face our work in the context of a national conversation about race. And while we continue to monitor and be involved in all of these conversations, we are this week going to kind of focus in on this one specific case, turning to the Supreme Court's blockbuster term and the release of one of the most highly anticipated cases before the court this term. The court released its opinions in the Title VII cases, as they're known. We say the Title VII cases because there are three cases, but they came down in one decision that advanced LGBTQ rights in employment. And just at the outset, we should say that the cases are not primarily about religious freedom. BJC did not file a brief in the case. We do not advocate for or against LGBT rights. That's not part of our mission, but we care about all rights and how they intersect with religious freedom and how to get that balance just right for faith freedom for all. But there are two reasons that we needed to devote an episode of Respecting Religion to these cases that we're going to talk about today. Number one, religious freedom is in the opinion. So while it was not primarily about that, it's in the background and the court is explicit about that. And then secondly, anyone who is following these cases and the controversies about LGBTQ rights will understand and be familiar with some controversies, discussion about how that impacts religious freedom. So those are the things that we're going to talk about today on this podcast. I'm looking forward to the conversation, Amanda.
Yeah, I am too. And before we dig into the opinion and the reaction, just a quick reminder on the background of the case. As you mentioned, it's a combination of three cases in one decision that will be known as Bostick versus Clayton County. And three cases where individuals all alleged that they were fired from their jobs for an illegal reason. Two cases involved discrimination in employment based on sexual orientation. Gerald Bostick, a child welfare services coordinator, and Donald Zarda, a skydiving instructor, were both gay men. And one case involving employment discrimination based on gender identity, Amy Stevens, who was a transgender woman. And I will note one sad fact of the case: of the three people who were fired from their jobs, only Bostick is alive to celebrate this big win. Amy Stevens died last month, and so she did not get to see the outcome of this case, though she saw it almost all the way through to completion. And Zarda died back in 2014, and his estate, his family, continued the case on his behalf.
And I'm really glad you mentioned that, Amanda, and there are lots of nice tributes to the individual plaintiffs in this case, because while this is a landmark case that affects so many people, it starts with an individual who goes forward with their claim, and they bear so much of the burden of the stress and the attention and the argument. And I think it's really important that people see the stories behind the big decision. And also because, as we'll talk about in the case, the word individual is important to the outcome of this case, in that Title VII protects individuals from sex discrimination. So you have these three individual stories that are important to understand, and I think say a lot about what's at stake in these cases.
Yeah, Holly, I thank you for saying that. And I do want to put in show notes, I saw a great human interest story that talked about Gerald Bostic and how he reacted to the news of the story. So we will include that in show notes.
That'll be good to see. And I just remind everyone that we are just getting this opinion and figuring out how far it goes, and people are digesting what it means, both those who are celebrating it and those who were on the opposing side. It's quite new, and the issues that we're going to be talking today are certainly going to be developing, and I'm sure BJC will continue to think about the case, and we'll have more to say about this later. In the meantime, there is quite a bit of celebration, as we saw in much of the media.
Yeah, there was not a big demonstration at the court, as we noted, but there were a lot of celebrations and statements and other gatherings online to talk about the impact of the case. And we'll put a link in show notes to the New York Times coverage of the decision, in which the paper says this decision is potentially the LGBTQ rights movement's most consequential victory, because the bottom line of the decision is now it is illegal to fire someone for being lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. It was considered a surprise, and it was particularly a surprise, as we'll get when we talk about the decision, in the vote count and in who delivered the opinion.
That's right. So let's talk about that decision. It is a big deal for a lot of reasons. It was a 6-3 decision with a majority opinion written by Justice Gorsuch, who is joined by Chief Justice John Roberts and the four more liberal justices. And even in one of the dissents, particularly the Justice Kavanaugh dissent, it was noted what a sort of groundbreaking advancement in LGBTQ rights the opinion is. It was also a big opinion as far as the size, which that happens a lot in these cases. People who aren't lawyers are sometimes surprised to learn how much is written in these decisions to explain how the court got there. So kind of adding to the drama of this decision is that it was released online, and most people got information about this through SCOTUS blog that monitors developments at the Supreme Court, and they announced the decision, but then the document wouldn't load. So we were all waiting for the decision. We found out that a decision is in the Title VII cases, and the front page comes up, but the rest of the decision doesn't for many, many minutes. And then you see, 172 pages. No wonder. So that was extra drama. But you know, the first thing that we learned is that it was a 6-3 decision written by Gorsuch. So we knew that it was going to be very significant. And as you note, and as that New York Times article noted, the primary holding of the decision is that an employer who fires an individual merely for being gay or transgender violates Title VII and therefore engages in unlawful employment discrimination. And as a lot of the reporting makes clear, this is a case of statutory interpretation. A lot of terms about language and the text of the congressional statute, Title VII, being that federal employment law from 1964 that makes it an unlawful employment practice for an employer to fail or refuse to hire or discharge any individual or otherwise discriminate in employment based upon the individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. So you see there, the word sex is in the statute, and that's what this case is about.
Yeah, when we talked about this case back in episode 5, we said, you know, these are the because of sex cases, because it all boiled down to what those terms meant. And that's the bulk of Justice Gorsuch's opinion for the court, is really going through in a painstaking way, looking at what language means, kind of going through each of the arguments on the other side, and looking for what he calls the ordinary public meaning of those very basic words.
The Gorsuch opinion states very plainly that cases dealing with sexual orientation or gender identity necessarily involve the term sex. He explains it in a way that makes it sound as if it's common sense and that it is not such a big deal to come to this conclusion.
Yeah, and I think that's quite intentional, of course. You know, for our non-lawyers in the audience who are not used to reading Supreme Court decisions, I would recommend this decision as one that's pretty straightforward. And I think that he's trying to make a case that this is, in a way, it's a big deal, but in a statutory interpretation way, it's not a big deal. Like, of course, this is what it means.
Exactly.
You get a very different view when you read the dissents. You know, right? I mean, that they look at the same words and they think that this is, you know, a ridiculous decision. You know, this is the, how could you possibly think that because of sex would apply to sexual orientation or gender identity?
You're right, Amanda, that Justice Gorsuch makes it seem plain and an easy conclusion. And he does that with the examples I think we talked about before, and that is, if you think about discrimination against a LGBT employee compared to a non-LGBT employee. And one way to think about that is, if you have two employees, a man and a woman, and each is attracted to women, but you take a negative employment action like firing the woman because she's attracted to women, then you are firing based upon LGBT status because you're necessarily firing her because of sex. So that's how the analysis goes for protecting gay and lesbian employees. And similarly, on gender identity, you're saying that if you take action against a transgender employee, you're doing so based upon what you assume they should be presenting as, which is literally taking into account and taking an employment decision based upon sex. And it's helpful that the opinion puts those examples out there so people can see the relationship to the word sex in the statute without having the word sexual orientation or gender identity. It's summed up in the opinion with a statement that an employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgender fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex. Sex plays a necessary and undistinguishable role in the decision, exactly what Title VII forbids.
So as plain as that is to Justice Gorsuch, and as he states in the opinion, it's as plain apparently to Justice Alito that the court is engaging in some kind of legislative act. In fact, that's how he starts his dissent. There is only one word for what the court has done today: legislation. The document that the court releases is in the form of a judicial opinion interpreting a statute, but that is deceptive. So this strong charge that he's making, that he's not just interpreting a statute, but that he's actually changing the meaning of the statute. But what was interesting to me was that line has gotten a lot of play in the press and then the reaction to the decision. But in reading Justice Gorsuch's opinion, I saw that he was in some ways accusing the dissents of doing the same thing, of not really engaging in statutory interpretation, but worrying more about the policy outcomes, acting like legislators in that way. In fact, he says that the dissent resorts to what he calls naked policy appeals. If we were to apply the statute's plain language, they complain, any number of undesirable policy consequences would follow. And there is a long 10 pages, actually, of Justice Alito's dissent is devoted to going through those possible policy outcomes. And Justice Gorsuch says that the place to make new legislation or address unwanted consequences of old legislation lies in Congress. So
it's really interesting because it's so clear that there are policy interest on both sides, right? I mean, we have these debates in state legislatures. We've had it in Congress. This is a topic of cultural conversation, right? But these are the justices of the United States Supreme Court, and their job is to interpret the law, and they have to have a basis for doing this. And both those in the majority and the dissent claim to be doing that based upon the text of the statute.
Let's take a break there, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how religious liberty comes up in this case.
We're back discussing the Bostick versus Clayton County case and how this employment discrimination case addresses religious liberty. For a case that we say is not primarily about religious liberty, that topic certainly did come up in this opinion. Before we talk about how it is mentioned in the decision, we should note that it makes sense that there were employers, and particularly religious employers, who filed on the side of the employers in this case because they were concerned about religious liberty implications for their institutions. So there were briefs dedicated to this topic in this case. Not because they were particularly concerned, perhaps, about coverage for LGBTQ people in non-discrimination statutes in general, but because perhaps they were concerned about how that would intersect with the way they run their religious institutions and their different commitments, different understandings of human sexuality, and just how these things would play out in many different contexts. And Justice Gorsuch saw that and responded. Toward the end of the opinion, I think it's the second to the last page of the opinion, he addressed an argument that came up in these briefs. And that was that some employers fear that complying with Title VII's requirement in cases like the one before the court may require some employers to violate their religious convictions. And he took that on very straightforwardly. He wrote, quote, "We are also deeply concerned with preserving the promise of free exercise of religion enshrined in our Constitution. That guarantee lies at the heart of our pluralistic society." So I think that's important to note, that strong statement, we, the court, he's talking about, and in this case, this is six members of the court in a majority, and we know that those in the dissent are also very concerned with religious employers. But he goes on to say that worries about Title VII and how it might intersect with religious liberty are nothing new. They even predate the statute's passage. So he's recognizing that, of course, there are going to be implications of this decision, but they aren't appropriate to influence the court's decision in this case with these secular employers.
Yeah, and in noting different protections for religious liberty, he goes back and cites particular statutes.
He does. He states that in order to protect our pluralistic society and these free exercise of religion concerns, there are several different ways that they may be protected. Well, when he says that Title VII may intersect with religious liberties and that that's not new, he shows us that. He reminds us that Title VII has a religious exemption for religious employers. And then he mentions the ministerial exception, a First Amendment doctrine that lets religious employers hire ministers without regard to any protected categories in most employment laws. And also he notes the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And basically by doing that, he says, you know, almost like it's no big deal. There are ways that these can be resolved in future cases where those issues arise and are argued by adversarial parties.
Yeah, he's flagging these things in a really simple way. And of course, none of these doctrines are simple, particularly as applied. And the ministerial exception in particular, as we've discussed on this podcast, that there is a pending case to really outline the contours of that ministerial exception. And I think that people will be watching for that decision even more closely now to see how that will interplay with this landmark case that makes clear the contours of Title VII.
And then on the other issues that he mentions the exemption to Title VII. Well, that's an exemption for religious organizations to hire and make employment decisions based upon religion. So it doesn't really address the question that we have here, where those religious institutions are covered by the anti-discrimination principles based on sex and national origin and race. And then, of course, he brings up the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Yeah, and he names the standard again that the RFRA prohibits the federal government from substantially burdening a person's exercise of religion unless it demonstrates that doing so both furthers a compelling government interest and represents the least restrictive means of furthering that interest. So just naming the balancing test again, and I think the big question will be that compelling government, well, more than one question, right? Compelling government interest. The government has a strong interest in enforcing its civil rights laws. And then what kind of burden does it put on a person's exercise of religion to hire someone, or I mean, really, that's what it would be, to hire or continue to work with someone who is gay or transgender.
Yes, this question about the interaction between LGBTQ non-discrimination laws and the RFRA standard has had a huge impact on the conversation about religious liberty in recent years. To my knowledge, there have been no successful RFRA claims, federal or state RFRA claims, that override a non-discrimination in employment statute that protects LGBTQ persons. But I guess we'll see now whether those claims, those cases will be brought and what kinds of decisions we might see in the future.
Yeah, it's left for another day by both the majority and also the dissent. I mean, Justice Alito in his dissent also raises again a long list of possible outcomes, some that are, I think, maybe more hot button culture war issues now, such as bathroom bills and things like that. Those are a little less, in my mind, directly related to the question in front of the court here. I think more on point, he does raise the issue of employment by religious organizations that Justice Gorsuch, you know, talks about directly. And I think also even more pointedly talks about the issue of the ministerial exception, particularly in the context of religious schools. So that connection is clearly on his mind here and about whether the schools there would have the ability to hire and fire and Title VII not apply at all to those positions.
I think it is not surprising that Justice Alito would go into much more detail about the ministerial exception cases and what's at stake, because we heard those oral arguments. We did a podcast on them. It's a tough issue to try to determine how far that doctrine will go and whether or not a school should be allowed to discriminate based upon all of these different protected categories by claiming that a wide range of its employees are ministers covered by that doctrine. Absent the ministerial exception doctrine, religious entities could say we hire people of our faith, but they are expected not to discriminate based upon other protected categories. And that now includes sexual orientation and gender identity. That's going to be a big change for a lot of religious institutions in the way that they operate now.
And I think that impact on religious organizations, we heard that in the kind of response that came immediately from this case. I worried that conversation about the potential impact of this case will further muddy the waters about what religious freedom means.
Well, as we've talked about in the past, questions over this topic of human sexuality and non-discrimination laws has had a huge impact on people paying attention to the term religious freedom. So it does make it hard sometimes to have a really good conversation about what's at stake, but we will. It's important. It's important that we do that. But I think you're right in the one immediate reaction will be that those who disagree with the opinion will say that it's bad for religious liberty. And some of those people would be able to go on and explain exactly how in ways that we would be quite sympathetic to, whereas others will be saying that and will have maybe no idea about the nuance of what that means. And unfortunately, I think many people who will fault the decision will say it's terrible for religious freedom simply because it is a decision that is at odds with their religious principles. And that is not what religious freedom means. There's not a religious freedom right for the law to line up perfectly with your religious principles, even your Christian religious principles, even your Christian traditional religious principles. We should remember and always note as we get into this discussion and we talk about the reactions, we want to be very respectful of the religious diversity and thinking on human sexuality. You know, there are different views within different traditions. And, you know, we have a lot to figure out, to work through, and that's what we're doing. And you mentioned earlier, Amanda, that article, the New York Times article about what a huge case this is, the most important case in the LGBTQ movement. And there was a lot of surprise at this decision. And as you and I talked about this previously, I think it's important to note that, and maybe that will make people be compassionate toward those who are reeling. They are reeling from this decision because they know that it has a huge impact on the culture and people's understanding of human sexuality and civil rights, maybe at odds with their religious teachings.
Yeah, I think that is really important to note, just the speed of the growing acceptance of the LGBTQ community, the legal protections that the community has fought so hard for and has gained in the last few years in a really accelerated way. The New York Times article also noted, you know, that this particular employment discrimination protection, this is one that they fought long for and really in some ways expected to get before marriage equality, that the marriage equality decision from 5 years ago was in some ways more of a surprise. This one had a lot more public support. I think the polls showed that over 80% of Americans felt that it was wrong to fire someone because of their sexual orientation. And so, but still, the decision came as a surprise.
It will take some time to work through this decision. And for those religious objectors to this case, to figure out how they will proceed to argue for their religious liberty and their religious institutions and how their rights will intersect with this decision. I think for today, for this week, as we got this important opinion, it's just most significant to recognize that ending employment discrimination based upon gender identity and sexual orientation has been a top priority for many civil rights groups for so long. And Justice Kavanaugh even had to recognize that in dissent. He filed a separate dissent from Justice Alito and has his own arguments about why he would have come out the other way. But he ends by saying, notwithstanding his concern about separation of powers and his decision saying that this was something that should have been determined by Congress, he notes that it's an important victory for gay and lesbian Americans. He says, millions of gay and lesbian Americans have worked hard for many decades to achieve equal treatment in fact and in law. They've exhibited extraordinary vision, tenacity, and grit, battling often steep odds in the legislative and judicial arenas, not to mention in their daily lives. And they have advanced powerful arguments and can take pride in today's result. So I think with that, we see the importance of this decision. Perhaps that's his nod to Justice Kennedy, who, of course, wrote some of the most important decisions that advanced the rights of the LGBTQ community. You know, for Justice Kavanaugh to be on the other side of this case is certainly disappointing for many in the LGBTQ community, but there he is, at least giving a nod to their achievement in the law. And with that, let's take a quick break.
So in this part of our conversation each week, Holly, we like to talk about what else other than reading Supreme Court decisions and reaction, what else we might be reading or watching or thinking about this week. I actually was listening to a different podcast. Shocking, I know. This is not the only podcast I listen to. I really enjoy the Ezra Klein Show for his political commentary, but more recently for some of the other kinds of conversations that he's been having. And this, maybe a few weeks ago, he had a conversation with Cyrus Habib, who is the Lieutenant Governor of Washington. He was considered by many to be a rising star in politics and public service, a very interesting personal story. He's an Iranian American. Both of his parents are from Iran, and he lost his sight to a rare form of childhood cancer at age 8. But that did not hold him back, and he went on to be a Rhodes Scholar and hold this political office at an early age. But people are taking note of him now because he is leaving all of this behind to become a Jesuit priest. So there's been a lot of commentary on this. Frank Bruni wrote a column about him for the New York Times, and Ezra Klein had a conversation with him, a 2-hour podcast conversation. But the conversation was very interesting to me as a respecting religion conversation, because Ezra is a respectful non-believer and Cyrus is a respectful believer. And they talked about the impact of religion on his life and all kinds of areas of ultimate concern and meaning from these two different perspectives. So I would really recommend this conversation. We'll put a link in show notes to anyone who might want to listen.
That sounds really interesting. And I know we love that, hearing people talk across lines, look for understanding from very different perspectives. I actually saw a movie this weekend, and it has a thoughtful minor, I don't know, depends on how you look at it, if it's minor or major religious theme, but I finally saw Just Mercy. I say finally, not because I'm usually so on top of movies, but because this one was so highly recommended. Of course, Just Mercy is a movie based on the book by Bryan Stevenson, the lawyer who has dedicated his life to representing people on death row and others who would not otherwise have legal representation. He founded the Equal Justice Initiative. And this movie stars Michael B. Jordan as Bryan Stevenson. And it's a wonderful movie that I can recommend without reservation. And particularly touching is how Bryan Stevenson, this African-American Harvard-educated lawyer, connects with an inmate through their shared experience of religion and church, but particularly music. I don't think it gives away too much just to say that there's a beautiful scene where that connection is made clear and the power of that connection for each of them gives strength in the face of, you know, particularly horrible circumstances. I just thought it was a powerful demonstration of religion and how it works. And for so many people in providing hope in times when it may be hard to find. And in recognition of the national conversation on race, I believe, and perhaps this week's Juneteenth holiday, you can find Just Mercy, I think, available on several platforms for free. I recommend that movie to anyone.
I'm going to add one more movie recommendation. It's not free. I think you can rent it on streaming services. You know, this week, June 17th, marked 5 years since the date when the 9 churchgoers were killed at Mother Emmanuel AME Church. And so there's a documentary out called Emmanuel, very powerful film. Of course, lots of religion throughout the film from many of the people who it's a documentary. And so talking about faith, talking about the faith of the people who were killed at the church, talking about how faith played a role in some of the victims' families, offering forgiveness and the conversation that ensued after that. So a lot of religious themes in that film. So I wanted to make a second film recommendation to our listeners today. And yes, as you note, this week is also Juneteenth, which is June 19th every year. As a Texan, I will say this holiday started in Texas, June 19th, 1865, when slaves in Texas learned about the Emancipation Proclamation. People who follow history will know that the Emancipation Proclamation took effect January 1st, 1863. It is in some ways a tragic holiday that it took 2.5 years for slaves in Texas to know that they were free and to be able to receive their freedom. But it has taken on a celebratory nature as a holiday to celebrate freedom. So BJC will celebrate Juneteenth this year with a Facebook conversation. Charles Watson, who joined our podcast last week, he and I will be in conversation on Facebook Live on Friday afternoon. So hope that our listeners will tune into Facebook Live for that conversation. And one more invitation for our listeners that next Friday, June 26th, BJC is hosting a national conversation on white supremacy and American Christianity. And our featured speaker is Robert P. Jones, who is a scholar, and he's the CEO and founder of PRRI. He's a leading commentator on religion, culture, and politics. And he is also the author of a new book coming out this summer called White Too Long, The Legacy of White Supremacy in American Christianity. And so he will be in conversation with Joy Reid, who is a political analyst for MSNBC. And our national conversation will be next Friday, June 26th, 12 noon Eastern. And we'll put a link in the show notes where you can register for this free event.
Thanks, Amanda. I hope all our podcast listeners will join us. It's going to be a great event, and we hope you all will join us and that you'll tell your friends because it'll be a challenging conversation for us.
That brings us to the close of this episode of Respecting Religion. Thanks for inviting us into your home or earbuds during this time of social distancing. For more details on what we discussed today, including links to the articles we mentioned, check out the show notes that go with this episode.
And tune in again next week. We release episodes in this podcast series every Thursday. You can see a list of all of them on our website. Visit bjconline.org/respectingreligion. And be sure to subscribe to the BJC podcast so you don't miss an episode. We're on all the major platforms.
Let us know what you think of the show on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at @BJCOnTheHill. And you can follow me on Twitter at @AmandaTylerBJC. And get to know us. Visit our website at bjconline.org to see how we've been working for faith freedom for all since 1936.
And join us again next week for a new conversation, Respecting Religion.